I was trying. I want to just kind of say three, tell you about three unsolved problems that where there's been some bit of progress recently, so that one can hope that there's kind of a breakthrough in progress. And I was trying to put my thoughts together about how to actually explain enough background for these things that high school audience would understand it. And so I thought, and I thought, and then I finally just this morning figured out the answer, which is that it's impossible. And so instead I'm just gonna say a bunch of incomprehensible stuff, and hopefully it'll be interesting anyway. I don't know, we'll see how it goes. But before that, or let me say it another way. If it seems incomprehensible, the one thought I hope you will not take away is this is incomprehensible. I better, stop studying physics. You should think, this is incomprehensible. That guy was a terrible lecturer or something like that. But anyway, just to be clear about that. But before that, you can't like put me in front of a room of high school students and expect me to just do the required task. I have to first take a few minutes to tell the three things that I wish were told to me when I was in high school, but instead were not, and I didn't figure them out until who knows when, the end of college or maybe sometime in grad school or maybe later. Anyway, it took me much longer. I wish I had known these things earlier. So the first thing is, I'm not even going to be able to articulate these things very well, but let's say when I meet people who are not physicists and they find out that I'm a physicist, there's sort of two reactions that I get. There's never a positive reaction. It's always like there's 70% of people are like, "Oh, that's math, right? Oh, like I hate math," which is actually very, very demoralizing to have 70% of people say that to you. But and then the other 30% of people are like, "Oh, that's math, right? I used to really love math when I was a kid, but then I got to such and such, and I tried to understand it. I just couldn't understand it, and I realized, math or physics is just not for me, not for me." So for everybody, it's something different. It's like, "Oh, I got to, calculus, and I realized it was just, over my head. I had to get out of that, and I decided to go into banking or I heard about entropy, and I just couldn't get my mind around it." And so I have three things to say about that. Basically, the first thing is I basically just that I think everybody, like I did this too, and I only know it in retrospect, really, but everybody jumps much too quickly to the conclusion that they can't understand this or that. Like one thing that happened was when I first got to college, and I was in my first couple of years studying and taking intro physics classes, there seemed to be other students who were understanding stuff much more easily than me, who were able to get their homework done much more quickly, in retrospect, there's some element of anyway, in retrospect, it's clear that a big element there is just that people just have very different levels of preparation coming into university. And a big part of the people who what's going on with the people who do things faster is just that they had been exposed to some topic earlier. They went to some, turned out that these kids who were, able to do all their freshman and sophomore homework super fast, they had gone to some fancy math and science high school that I didn't know about. But in practice, everyone just likes the idea that they're super smart, and they try to give off the impression that if they're doing better or doing things faster, that it's just pure natural ability. And then the people who are doing things slower believe that, and they get discouraged by it. So anyway, don't get discouraged by that. I think that's often not what's going on. A second thing is just that an important thing was just to kind of get comfortable with understanding something more abstractly. Like a lot of times when people encounter something, like they'll say, oh, you know, I found out that, you know, space-time was four-dimensional, and I just couldn't get my brain around that, or something like that. And what that you know, often means is that they can't visualize four dimensions or something. But you know, that's just part of life. That a lot of the most important things in mathematics, or a lot of the most important topics in understanding physics, as you go on, they are things where you are not, at least initially, going to be able to visualize them. But you just got to relax about that. I mean, even if you can't visualize them, you can still just learn to manipulate the rules, and in a self-consistent way, where you can still have perfectly good understanding of what the right answer is, and whether the answer you've derived is correct or not, even if you can't visualize anything. And then frequently, you know, because of the way the human brain is set up, frequently, you know, kind of visual intuitive understanding comes later, one way or another. But you know, basically, just let go. You know, like, just let go. You just don't need to. A lot of people's anxiety about when they quote unquote don't understand something has to do with just a strong need to have a very sort of concrete visual understanding of something. And you know, all I can tell you is I let that go, and my life got better. You know, everything got easier, everything got more fun. You could learn about much more stuff. And then finally, the final point is just that, you know, when people say that they didn't understand something, I mean, usually upon inspection, what that means is that, basically what I mean is this. It is routine, absolutely routine. What is my day job? I come in, I read a paper that I think is interesting for some reason, I don't understand it at all. So then I read it again, and then I understand like a little bit more, but 99% I still don't understand it. You know, it's routine that I have to read something, you know, 10 times or something like that before I begin to understand it. Or let's say a topic that I'll be telling you about in a moment, sort of the second problem that I want to tell you about. You know, it literally took years of banging my head against, there's this great French mathematician. He wrote what are clearly a very remarkable breakthrough, but the papers are incomprehensible. And, you know, I just sort of read them, didn't understand anything, went off and did something I did understand, came back and read them, didn't understand anything. And that literally went on for years. And, yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's if you kind of take the perspective that's just the way it is, and that not understanding something is not a sign that you are an idiot, but that that it's a sign often more that there's something very interesting, and you just need to give your brain is something very non-trivial, and you need to give yourself a chance to comprehend it. That'll just make your life better. You'll go further if you take that attitude, I think. Anyway, the other thing. So that was kind of screed number one. Now you were hoping there was no screed number two. There's this brief screed number two, which is just that. You know, so if you go to university and you decide to study physics, there's going to be you'll take a lot of physics classes, and you'll take, you know, Introduction to Classical Mechanics, Introduction to Electromagnetism, et cetera. You'll go through and you'll learn sort of the basic tools on which the sort of basic foundations on which modern physics is built. You know, really what you want to do is discover something. Make a big discovery, discover something interesting. And you know, this is not enough to do that. It's like if you wanted to be a great composer, and you know, you learned you went to university and you took a course in harmony and you took a course in counterpoint, and took all these courses in music theory, and at the end of the day, you know, and you like learned, you know, to, yeah, you understand what I mean, and at the end of the day, you're like, okay, I graduated, you know, time to compose something. Well, you know, that stuff is not enough. That stuff is important, but it's no substitute for studying, you know, the masters. I mean, it's no substitute for sort of familiarity with the works of, you know, if you, let's say you wanted to be a classical composer, familiarity with the works of Bach or you know, Beethoven has a quality that you know, those courses, the courses that teach you the basic techniques, don't alert you to. You know, it's another equally important thing that is just not being taught in those courses, and you just have to sort of do for yourself. I mean, you know, like let's say, what is the normal thing that's done? Normal thing is you take these courses, you get a lot of background, and then you go. Let's say you decide to go to grad school. You decide you want to go on and do research in physics. So you go to grad school, you get accepted in some grad schools, and maybe you go around and visit them and talk to the different advisors, and you see who has the most interesting project, the project that sounds the coolest to you, and you go work with that person, and you hope that they will just have a good sense of what interesting problems are, and you later on will develop that sense. You know, that's just a very dangerous thing to do. It's likely that in fact the great advisor with what sounded like an awesome project when you were an undergrad, on closer inspection, you know, is a crazy project, or is more boring than you originally realized on closer inspection, or is not really leading. Leading anywhere, or is something that relates to something great that the advisor did 30 years ago, but has never moved on from. You know, it's just much better to be supplementing that with as early as possible with developing your own sense of what are interesting problems. And the thing I want to say is that the point of the classical music analogy was that there's really no substitute. These classes will not do that. There's no substitute for sort of studying the masters. So, you know, there's certain people who were or are just great at a different kind of thing. They might not be the best at solving a problem posed to them or something like that, but in terms of just being alert to what is interesting in the world, patterns in the world or in mathematics, being alert to those things and noticing what are the interesting problems that are out there. And there's I think the best thing is to just see what those, you know, over the scope of their lives, what these sort of special people did. It's the best lesson you can get to just get a. So I have kind of a list of who I consider to be some of the stars of. The 20th century in this regard. Okay, Einstein, of course. Everybody knows about him. John von Neumann is another one. Eugene Wigner. Emmy Noether was another one. There's a guy, Freeman Dyson. Roger Penrose. John Conway. You know, I think those guys are those people are the A team. I mean, let me just think. Am I forgetting anybody? Yeah, I mean, those are the A team. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. Four. You know, you can kind of find out either on the internet or, you know, once you go to university, the library will have a collection of these guys' collected works or, you know, collected papers. Or a lot of them have written great popular, are also sort of great writers for popular audiences, and you can learn there. But I mean, so each of these people did such a amazing array of, you know, noticed interesting things about completely different topics. They sort of were very unusual in their ability to spot interesting things in the world, and. Yeah, you know, it just learning about what they worked on, just getting a basic sense of what are the different problems that they tried to solve, is really the best education you can get in terms of developing your own sense of what, your sort of own antenna for what is interesting. And I just had a couple, along with this, I had a couple of book recommendations that I wrote down. Okay, so first of all, Freeman Dyson has written a lot of great stuff. He had this sort of stupendous career of discovering interesting stuff up until he was about 60 or something like that. And then from 60 to 90, he's still going at this. He's been just sort of not doing technical work, but writing popular essays what can you say about them? They don't necessarily hold together on close inspection, but they're really extremely, extremely interesting and, like I say, very good at this thing I'm trying to encourage you to do. And so, in particular, I would just start with his first thing he wrote when he was about 60 was a memoir called Disturbing the Universe. Which I really recommend. And basically anything you can get your hands on by this guy is great. And let's see. And then another thing is, so John Conway doesn't write popular books himself, but he was sort of throughout his career in contact with this other guy, Martin Gardner, who was a great sort of 20th century popularizer of mathematics. He wrote this great weekly column in Scientific American for a long time. And that's another book I recommend. That Martin Gardner, there's sort of a collection of his greatest hits called Martin Gardner's Colossal Book of Mathematics. That's another book to look at, and that's sort of a popular way to learn about a bunch of interesting ideas of Conway's, but then also a lot of other stuff. And then one other thing, there is this book. So another idea of Conway's was these so-called surreal numbers. And so this is some gigantic number system that sort of contains all of the other number, all of the smaller number systems considered in mathematics. It's really a very fascinating thing. So Donald Knuth sort of heard about this from Conway at some point in the 70s, and he wrote this short, one, like 90-page novelette, sort of introducing the idea called, I won't write the title. It's called Surreal Numbers. How 2X students turned on to pure mathematics and found total happiness. Okay, so as a work of fiction, this is appallingly bad. It is like the worst novel ever written. But after you're done retching, if you continue, it is just an incredible, first of all, it's a great introduction to this topic, which is interesting on its own, but that's kind of not the point. It is kind of a great, if you hold your nose about the literary qualities of it, it is a really great introduction to kind of how you would think about work your way through a problem slowly as a researcher, or find the kernel of an idea and then kind of fiddle your way through it until you understand it properly. And also, I think very good training in kind of sort of letting go and thinking abstractly, like I was saying, letting go of your sort of concrete traditional, you know, the real numbers and integers are the classic thing that we have a deep intuitive sense of, and their connection to the real world, and sort of letting go of that and finding that there's something much more interesting that they're contained in. And this thing, you shouldn't be able to read it in one go. It's more like I would recommend trying to read. In 4-page chunks or something like that each day, and let it kind of work, making sure you understand that and absorbing it, and then moving on. But anyway, okay, that's it. That took a little bit longer than I had imagined, but what can I say? I'm getting old, as I say. Presented with a group of high school students, I just feel an urge I can't suppress to give advice. Anyway, as I say, these things I would have loved to have heard them when I was in high school. And who knows? If I just wasted your time, I apologize. Nope. Okay. So now I just wanted to sort of tell you about three. What did I do?
It took Kelly about a week to figure out how to make the board move. That's all.
Oh yeah. I've had experience with them before. Again, this is one of those things. Kelly, I hope you will not conclude that you are dumber at board use than me. It turns out I gave a cosmology course in here, which was like a...
Do you teach in the sci program?
I teach the cosmology class, yeah. In this room, so I know these boards intimately. Okay, so let's see. Now we get to the part where I want to introduce you to three problems where I think they're all like super hot right now. Where there's something really, there's a lot of interesting problems out there, but a lot of them, and like especially the ones that you read, I feel like the ones that one reads about in the newspaper or something, have been kind of, these problems, in my opinion, are just tremendously interesting, but then in addition, they have the property that they just became. There's a reason to think that they haven't just been sitting around. Okay, there's other tremendously interesting problems, like you might have heard of one called the Riemann hypothesis. But every great mathematician since Riemann has worked on that one, and so I wouldn't, bet my most valuable possession on the possibility that it will be solved tomorrow. But something has happened recently in each of them where, I do think that there's going to be a lot of progress on these in the coming year, and hopefully I'll arouse your interest in some of them, even though, as I say, my description of each of them will likely be incomprehensible. Okay, so the first one, I want to tell you about the search for the theory of so-called partially massless gravity. And then I want to tell you about this. Then I want to tell you that there is this great French mathematician named Alain Kahn, who kind of developed this new branch of mathematics called non-commutative geometry, and how the sort of basic laws of physics, as we currently understand it, the standard model of particle physics, how it seems like this collapses into a much more succinct and elegant and more highly constrained structure when expressed in this language. Or to say it another way, it looks like, in my opinion, there is good evidence that the underlying structure of space-time is not Riemannian geometry like we have thought since Einstein, but is this kind of slight modification or generalization of that called non-commutative geometry. Basically, I want to tell you about the search for the four-dimensional Penrose tiling. There is this beautiful thing in two dimensions called the Penrose tiling, and then there's a beautiful 3D analog of it, which was found a decade later. And then, it was recently realized that there will be a 4D analog of that, and then that's it. That's it. But so there's some very special 4D discretization of 4D space with magical properties. And he searches on to find that and then understand if there's, usually if there's a very special structure and it has the same dimension as the space-time we live in, you should be alert to the possibility that it could connect to that. And so, okay, so those are the three things. Let me try to say a little bit about that. So this search for partially massive gravity. So what's going on there? You know, something that you have probably heard about one place or another is that cosmological observations. Let me say it this way. So our modern theory of gravity is now 100 years old. Okay, it's Einstein's theory of general relativity, and it has passed a slew of tests in the solar system, but you know it's much less well tested on scales larger than the solar system, so on scales of the cosmos. But nevertheless, the predominant view is that general relativity is correct on cosmological scales. And if you assume that GR is correct, is the right theory of gravity, even when you apply it to gigantic length scales of the whole observable universe, then there's this funny fact, which is that all cosmological observations seem to suggest that, you know, the ordinary matter, the matter you find in the periodic table, is only about 5% of the current energy density of the universe, and then another 25% is so-called dark matter, some largely mysterious substance with zero pressure, and then the remaining 75%, 70%. Is dark energy, which is some even more mysterious substance with large negative pressure. Okay, and you know, and that has sort of been that story solidified more than 15 years ago now, and there's been very little progress since then. Okay, there's been tons and tons of money spent on tons and tons of beautiful experiments, hoping to uncover more about these guys, what their nature is. Take us the next step so that we understand them at a more fundamental level, the way we understand this stuff. And you know, basically, to make a long story short, there's been no progress. Okay, so there's been. For most importantly, it continues to be the case, as it was back then, that the only evidence for these things is by their gravitational interaction. Okay, so you know, despite many experiments trying to look for look for these guys in other ways, non-gravitational ways. Let's like, for example, there are deep underground experiments that we're supposed to be able to detect the most popular dark matter particle candidates as they banged into these underground detectors. Those have turned up nothing. There are a variety of other experiments here that have turned up nothing. You know, so okay, so it could very well still be this is right, that GR is correct, and that there really is this stuff, and that, you know, just too bad. It's just harder to find out about, it's just harder to learn about observationally than this stuff is. You know, a natural question to ask is whether maybe this original assumption is wrong, since the only evidence for these two things is gravitational. You might ask, well, could it be instead that these two things, you know, aren't there or don't have the character that we think they have after all, and that really it's our assumption that GR is correct that's wrong? Maybe the right theory of gravity on cosmological scales is something that's not quite the same as general relativity, but simply looks like general relativity when you approximate it on solar system scales, which is, again, where we really have our tests. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that, so by far, this is still the predominant view, that this is what's going on. And so, you know, why is it that so few people are considering the alternative, modifying GR? Well, it turns out to be very hard to do. You know, a lot of people attempted to modify GR, and it turns out to be very hard to modify it in a way that it's very hard to modify Einstein's theory in a way that remains self-consistent or doesn't completely violate the experimental constraints on GR in the solar system. So if you want to both satisfy the constraints in the solar system and not have a theory that is completely inconsistent with itself and makes no sense, it's been hard to produce such a theory. And in fact, there was a theorem in the 70s by Bulwar and Deser, which was supposed to show that it was impossible. So to make a long story short, this is not true. So in 2011, you know, there's an escape clause. This is actually another very important thing that I'm just okay. So I'm susceptible to this. Advice giving. So this is another thing. No Go theorems are great. You prove theorems about what is impossible, you know, and that helps people out by making sure they don't waste a lot of time trying to get something to work when someone else has already proved that it's impossible. Except that another big thing about no-go theorems is that there's always like unanticipated escape clauses if you read the fine print, and people usually don't read all the fine print, and so don't look in a certain area because they think it's been ruled out by a no-go theorem, when in fact, sort of the most interesting thing is hiding over there through a little escape clause in the no-go theorem. Anyway, that's what happened here. So there was this in 2011. So general relativity, the basic particle there is the graviton, and it has spin two. So it has every one of them, every graviton is supposed to be spinning with have a spin angular momentum, which is equal to 2 times Planck's constant, and mass 0. And this theorem was supposed to say that there is no consistent theory of a spin 2 particle. If something is a spin 2 particle, you physicists will call that the graviton. And the theorem was supposed to say that there is no, that this is the only possibility. There is no consistent theory with m not equal to 0. And so that was what was discovered in 2011. It's now become really a breakthrough. It's become already a famous theory with the names of the discoverers attached to it, DRGT theory. I should say, by the way, this is Durham, this is Durham, Claudia Durham and Andrew Tully were both postdocs here. Actually, they had left here right before they discovered this thing, unfortunately. It would be a great claim to fame for Perimeter if they discovered it here. But anyway, so what is this theory? Well, in short, it is a perfectly self-consistent. It's the sort of complete set of self-consistent theories of a single spin two particle with mass not equal to 0. Okay, so for a long time, it had seemed that there was just no good real modification of general relativity on large scales because of this sort of uniqueness theorem. You know, people had come up with people had come up with proposed modifications of GR, but they were either not consistent with themselves, and the idea was you were just supposed to not worry about that and try to work out their consequences anyway, or they were just super ugly, so ugly that no one could get really interested in them, and they didn't seem to have much explanatory power. They were so sort of loose and unexplanatory. Okay, but here we go. We suddenly, as of a couple of years ago, have this perfectly self-consistent, very natural extension of general relativity to play with. So this has been a big development, and a lot of people now have been working on this. In particular, there was a follow-up paper by another postdoc here, Kurt Hinterbickler, and his collaborator Rachel Rosen, who sort of showed this was originally found and it was consistent. It evaded that, but it looked ugly. But like with all good consistent things that hang together mathematically, turns out secretly when you understand it correctly, it really is very beautiful. So what we really now have is it's clear that there is a beautiful and consistent extension of general relativity, and people are now many people are now trying to work out the cosmological consequences of this theory. You know, what does it really say about cosmology? The thing I want to talk about, so this I would call massive gravity, okay? So then what is partially massless gravity? So it seems likely that there is another theory which is partway in between general relativity and this theory. So one way to say it is a massless graviton has two polarizations. Okay. So we say the helicity of the graviton. So if you take its two units of spin and you project them on the z-axis, it can only have two possible projections. The projection of its spin onto the z-axis is either +2 or -2. So there's only these two possible polarizations. When in this theory where m is not equal to 0, there are 5 polarizations. Okay, so the helicity can take any value between +2 and -2. Including plus or minus 1 and 0. So there is a good reason to think that there is this theory with mass not equal to 0, but only 4 polarizations. So in other words, the helicity 0 polarization is ruled out. So first of all, why is it interesting? Why is this thing interesting? Now, why do you want to find it? Well, first of all, if this theory exists, it turns out that it turns out the sort of key component in modern physical theories, they're sort of governed by their symmetries. So there's a certain set of transformations on the variables in the theory that leave the theory invariant, just like if you take a sphere and you do any rotation of the sphere, you know, it looks just like the sphere that you started with. Well, these theories have these, you know, the theories that describe, like the standard model of particle physics or Einstein's gravity, they have these enormous groups of symmetries, which are sort of the fundamental thing governing their structure. There's an enormous set of transformations on the variables, such that when you do those transformations, the theory after the transformation looks exactly the same as the theory before the transformation. Well, this theory is, even though it hasn't been found yet, it's known that it's a theory that's a lot like this theory, except it has one extra symmetry, and that one extra symmetry kills this one helicity. But it has several consequences. If this theory exists, it only appears to exist in 4 dimensions. So it would be an explanation of what is otherwise an unexplained fact about the universe, which is that it has 4 dimensions. Why does the universe have 3 space and 1 time dimensions? This theory appears to be a route to explaining that. It also has no cosmological constant problem. Okay, so this, in Einstein's theory, has this extra term you can add to it called the cosmological constant. And that extra term could actually be the explanation for what the dark energy is. If you make that extra term in the action positive and very, very tiny, positive and equal to a very tiny value, 10 to the minus 120, so in other words, 0 point, and then 120 zeros, and then 1, that can explain why the universe is accelerating today. But then you're left with the question of why is the value of that constant this extremely strange number, 120 orders of magnitude less than its natural value, which is 1. So in other words, if you go talk to any person in the building who works on quantum field theory, they will tell you they think they can predict what the value of this constant should be, and it should be about 1. And so instead, they're off by 120 orders of magnitude, and the question is why? And that's called the cosmological constant problem. So these two theories are both plagued by that problem. This theory turns out not to be. This extra symmetry is basically the explanation for why this value could be arbitrarily small, and that would be completely reasonable. And then finally, it looks like, as interesting as this theory is, when you compare it to cosmology, it looks like, although it's not clear yet, this is kind of what people are still trying to work out, it looks likely that this mode is going to cause trouble. It looks like this mode is probably going to come into observational conflict with cosmological data. So for that more experimental reason, it's probably going to be good to get rid of it. So people are trying to look for this theory. I mean, last year, actually, a guy had a proposal. I actually spoke to this group last year, and there was this guy, Fawad Hassan, in Stockholm, who had a well-located place. Stockholm is where Nobel Prizes are awarded, and so it's a good place to have a proposal for a breakthrough discovery of a new theory. So he had this proposal, and a bunch of cross-checks seemed to suggest that it was correct, and I was super excited about this last year, and I was like, oh, this guy found it, you should all know his name, and okay, so it turned out not to be right. And then later in the year, me and Kurt Hinterbickler had another proposal that it looked like it was going to be right, and then it turned out to not be right. And so what can I say? This problem is just not solved yet, but it looks for various reasons like very likely that this theory exists, very likely that it is very interesting and relevant for our universe. It's a new problem. It only emerged within the past couple of years. And really, although quite a few people have been working on understanding this theory, a much smaller group of people have so far set their mind to trying to find this theory. So I just wanted to mention I can't really get into too much of the technical details of except to say, I think that's an interesting thing if you want to learn about it. By the way, I was going to mention, if you do want to learn more about the technical details, and now this, there was a great talk given by Kurt Hinterbickler here a couple of months ago. A sort of review talk about it. Now, this is a review talk that was pitched at grad students and postdocs, so it's not pitched at high school students. But nevertheless, I'm sure you'll get tons out of it, and it's certainly much more comprehensible than what I just said. So it's Kurt Hinterbickler, and you can find it. The video of it, if you're interested, is on the Perimeter website that archives the seminars. So the website is persa.org. And if you just search for Hinterbickler, you'll see his most recent talk is on this topic. And it's really good if you want to see a snapshot of what the current state of things is and what the theory looks like. Okay, but that's all I was going to say about that. I don't necessarily have to push on to. Well, I will. What do you say? Yeah. Questions about this, or just keep plowing forward? Plow. Okay. The plows win. Okay, so now this next one, as I say, I wanted to tell you about this mathematician Alain Kahn and how he developed this idea of non-commutative geometry, and which appears to give a more appropriate description of if you say oh no, the universe is not. See, in Einstein's theory of gravity, the idea is that the universe is a curved space-time, and that the mathematics describing that curved space-time is something called Riemannian geometry, differential geometry. And so Kahn says, no, there is this. So it's kind of analogous, you know. So back in ancient times, Euclid had this notion of flat space geometry, and it was thought that the world was described by flat space Euclidean geometry. That was thought for thousands of years. And then in the mid-1800s, Riemann came along and invented this differential geometry, the geometry of curved spaces. And at the time, it seemed to not describe our universe. It was thought to just be a mathematical, just a generalization of Euclidean geometry that only mathematicians could be interested in. And but then Einstein's big discovery, or one of his big discoveries, was that no, that's exactly the mathematics needed to describe gravity, his theory of general relativity. So this is kind of analogous to that. In the early 80s, this guy Kahn found that there was, just like Riemannian geometry was a generalization of Euclidean geometry, he found this very interesting further generalization of Riemannian geometry. And again, at the time, it seemed like something only of interest to pure mathematicians, not of relevance to the real world. And then, starting in the mid-90s, he began to realize, actually, it appears to be exactly what is needed to give a more succinct description of the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And so to show you what I mean by that, it'll give me an opportunity to show you another thing, which I wish I had been shown much earlier than I was, which is just the Lagrangian for the Standard Model of Particle Physics. So in other words, the formula that describes the laws of physics as we currently know it. Somehow, even though I majored in physics in university, no one ever showed me that formula. Like not through the end of university. It was sometime a couple of years into grad school when I had learned a lot about the Standard Model, but could I actually write down the theory in full and then just see what it was in one place? No. And so then when I finally just learned the formula, this one formula is sort of what you can then derive everything else from. It really makes things much easier to understand. And I kind of wish I had seen it much earlier, because then I would have known that was really the thing to aim for. Really, by the end of university, if I had known about it, if I had known that was my goal, I could have understood this formula and sort of, which is sort of the condensation of all of what we've learned about the fundamental laws of nature up to this point. Anyway, so I'm just going to show you. I'm just going to sort of present the formula and how and the algorithm for getting it. And again, it'll be largely incomprehensible, but at least you'll get something. You'll get some sense of what the formula is, where it comes from, and you'll at least know what to aim for better than I did. Okay, but so Sorry, for some reason I decided. Okay, I'm falling apart. Yeah. Okay, but let me start by saying another even more basic thing, which is that one of the things, if you're interested in doing theoretical physics, one of the things to try to learn first when you get to university, if you haven't heard about it, I had not heard about it until I got to university, is our are these two reformulations of Newtonian mechanics due to Lagrange and Hamilton. Okay, so Lagrangian or Hamiltonian. Dynamics. Okay, so in other words, what's the idea here? So as I learned about Newtonian mechanics in high school, the idea was Newton had this equation, which was that F was equal to ma. And then if someone gave you a formula for what F was, so for example, Newton said that if the force is the gravitational force, then there's some formula for what there's some formula like GMM over R squared for what F is, then you could try to solve this equation in various simple contexts. Okay, but it turns out that in the 1800s, this same idea was reformulated. Newton's laws of motion were reformulated in two different ways, which were sort of more mathematically beautiful, but again, throughout the 1800s, looked like a purely a mathematical curiosity. And so they're really just two different ways of phrasing this guy. But then it turned out, once the 20th century arrived and quantum mechanics arrived, you know, Dirac basically realized that these two things were the key. If you tried to think of quantum mechanics as an extension of this, you were lost. But if you tried to think of quantum mechanics as an extension of one of these two rephrasings of this, then life was good. Okay? And so in short, the idea of Lagrangian mechanics is that there is some function called the Lagrangian, which is a function of basically the positions and the velocities of the particles that you want to describe. Okay, so it's a function of the positions and their velocities. And then once I tell you that function, and you've learned the idea of Lagrangian mechanics, from that function you can derive everything. You can by manipulating this equation, you can derive this one. By manipulating this formula, you can derive this one. And furthermore, in quantum mechanics, if you're given this formula, you can use it to derive everything about the quantum mechanical predictions of that system. And then there's a similar thing over here. The Hamiltonian is another function. Now it's a function of the positions and the momenta of the particles in the theory. But the basic idea is similar. There's once I give you this, the idea is if I want to specify a physical system, a physical theory, I give you the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian for that theory, and there is some crank you can turn then, or some process you go through to extract from either of these two formulas all the predictions of that theory. So as I say, this has turned out to be a much more powerful way to look about, to think about classical mechanics and then quantum mechanics. And so according to the modern view, when I say, you know, the standard model of particle physics, what I really have in mind is what is the Lagrangian for the standard model of particle physics. So there's some formula that depends on all of the different fields in physics and their first time derivative, their velocity, so to speak. And it's a generalization of the simplest Lagrangian. So the simplest Lagrangian describing a particle in moving in a potential v of x, so a particle of mass m moving in a potential v of x. So in other words, by potential v of x, I mean the force over here. So Newton's law for this system would be the force derived from that potential would be minus the derivative of the potential minus dv dx is equal to m, and then times the acceleration, which is the second derivative of X with respect to time. Anyway, if you depend, I'm not even sure whether or not how many of you have taken calculus or have seen Newton's law phrased this way. So, if you don't recognize this, that's fine. But anyway, the point is just that this system, which according to Newton would have been phrased in this language, the Lagrangian for that. Well, the Lagrangian is, roughly speaking, always just the kinetic energy of the system minus the potential energy of the system. So in other words, whereas the total energy would be the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, this Lagrangian function you get by figuring out the kinetic energy and the potential energy and taking their difference. So in this case, for example, it would be 1/2 mv squared. That's the kinetic energy, and then minus the potential energy, V of X. Okay, so that's the Lagrangian describing sort of the simplest quantum mechanical system. Now we want to say I just want to write down for you the formula for the Lagrangian of the standard model, the Lagrangian that actually summarizes what we know about physics to date. And you'll see it's on the one hand it's amazingly short, given how much it describes. And on the other hand, it's a gigantic mess with a lot of stuff that's sort of unexplained about it. But first I have to tell you, so there's sort of a three-step process for producing the Lagrangian. I have to give you three inputs. So first, I have to tell you, according to the usual algorithm, the first thing I need to tell you when specifying the current laws of nature are the symmetries of the laws of nature. And so I'm going to tell you that they are they're going to be Poincaré invariants, what Poincaré invariants is just the symmetries that of special relativity, the symmetries that of the theory of special relativity that Einstein discovered. The fact that the laws of nature look the same as measured by a person with his lab over here, as they do by a person with their lab over there, and they also look the same to a person with their lab here at rest, and a person with their lab over here but flying by at constant velocity v, and they look the same to a person with their lab here oriented this way versus a person with their lab here oriented this way. You know, all those different physicists will do the same experiments and extract the same laws of nature. So that's one symmetry. And then there are also so-called internal symmetries, gauge symmetries, which, anyway, they are what they are. I'm just going to write this mysterious formula on the board and leave it at that. There's some group of symmetries. And anyway, once I've told you that these are the space-time symmetries and these are the gauge symmetries, I'm done with step one, but now that's not yet enough for you to figure out what the Lagrangian is. I need to tell you another bit of input now. Well, so the particles in the standard model come in three types. Okay, there are spin one particles called gauge bosons. And it turns out the number of gauge bosons and their properties are completely determined once I've told you this information, the symmetries of the theory. So I don't need to tell you anything more about them. But there's two other types of particles, spin 1/2 particles called fermions. Most of the particles in the standard model are these guys. Like the electron is a fermion, or the quarks that are inside atoms, inside atomic nuclei are fermions. And then there's spin zero particles, so-called scalars. Well, actually, it appears to be the case that there's only one of these, and it's the famous Higgs boson. So as I say, once I've told you the symmetries of the theory, I've told you everything you need to know about these guys, their number and how they transform under the symmetries. But I still need to tell you how many of these there are. That's step two. So let's make, so we have to make a little table here, where along the top, along the horizontal axis of the table, I have my three gauge symmetry groups. And each row in the table is a different fermion in the standard model. Okay, so, well, I'll just have to list, I just list to you as another, in the, according to the usual approach, another unexplained input of the theory is just what is the list of the fermions? Well, turns out that there are left-handed quarks. There's sort of there's a left-handed quark, which secretly is a combination of two guys, the up quark left-handed and the down quark left-handed. And then there are the right-handed partners of these, which each get their own line in the table. So there's the up-handed right quark and the right-handed up quark and the right-handed down quark. And then there's three more guys, which are these called the leptons. So those are like electrons and neutrinos. So just like there was a single left-handed quark, there's a single left-handed lepton, which is secretly a combination of two guys, the left-handed electron, the left-handed neutrino and the left-handed electron. And then there is the right-handed neutrino and the right-handed electron. Okay, and I'm still not done with step two. Step two, I still have to tell you, I have to fill in the table. I have to tell you how each of these fermions changes, how it transforms under this symmetry. So this is going to be, this is some symmetry, some set of transformations that if I take all of the variables in my Lagrangian and I transform them, the Lagrangian will be carried into itself. It won't change under those transformations. Even though all the variables inside the Lagrangian change, the function as a whole will not change. Okay, that's what we mean by a symmetry, a symmetry of the theory in the Lagrangian language. And okay, so I'm not going to really explain this except that this is some table of numbers that where the numbers tell you how these particles transform under each of these, how these fermions transform under each of these symmetries. So the quarks all transform as a triplet under SU3, whereas the leptons do not transform under SU3. They transform as a so-called singlet. And this is basically saying these guys do feel the strong force. The quarks do feel the strong force. The leptons do not feel the strong force. SU3 is the symmetry governing the strong force. That's just an unexplained thing I have to fill in as an input before you can write down the standard model. Then another thing is that another unexplained input is that an observed fact of nature is that to get the standard model Lagrangian, you have to assume that the left-handed fermions, these two guys, are doublets under SU2. In other words, they do feel the weak force. This column is the weak force. All the right-handed fermions do not. They're all singlets under SU2. And then finally, there's a third guy, which is U1 hypercharge, which is kind of similar to electromagnetism, but not the same. And I have to tell you what charges these guys have under that. So anyway, they all have different weird charges. Okay, so step two is now complete. You see, we had to give a lot of extra input here. I had to make up a list of fermions, and I had to make up a table of numbers that told you how those fermions transform under symmetries. And then we're still not done. I still have to tell you what are the scalar fields in the theory and what are their charges. Well, it's just an unexplained input in the ordinary approach to the standard model that there is only one scalar field called the Higgs boson. And it's just an unexplained fact about it that it does not feel the strong force, that it does feel the weak force with charge 2, and that it does feel the hypercharge force with charge 1/2. Okay, so now I've given you all the inputs I need to write down the standard model Lagrangian. So now, given this table, I'm instructed to just take these fields and write down every combination of these fields that I can think of, which is invariant under so that the formula that I get at the end of the day has this property that I said, that even though the fields are all transforming in different ways under these symmetries, the formula as a whole that I write down does not transform. It's invariant. That's what it means for these things to be a symmetry. Okay, let me take another poll. So I'm tempted now to again write down the formula, both to show you how short and beautiful it is and how long and gross it is. That'll be like 5 minutes, and then I should probably just briefly say, we might have to jettison the 4D Penrose tiles, I think. Should I be stopping already?
You go all the way to 12.
Okay.
And these guys can ask you questions along the way if they're.
Yes. So anyway, I've completely stunned you into silence with incomprehensibility. Okay. Okay. Well,
you guys want to go across again?
That sounded fake. Anyway, but it was very kind of you guys though, and I'm gonna take it as a license to go ahead. Okay, so you know the basic idea is that we are going to first write down all of the terms that we can make that. That are kinetic terms, kinetic energy terms, meaning that just like this term here, they don't just involve the field, but they involve the derivative, a space-time derivative of the field, okay? So we're going to write down all the terms we can think of that are derivatives of the field, that involve derivatives of the fields, and then that's the kinetic energy, and then we're going to write all the terms we can think of that don't involve derivatives, that are just purely, where I purely construct the function from the fields themselves without taking any derivatives of them. And those will be the potential terms. And then that'll be everything we can write down. And people did that in the 70s. They worked out all the predictions. They work great. People have been hoping to do experiments that don't agree with those predictions. And for 40 years, they've been out of luck. It's been working great ever since. So, okay, let's see. Well, first, I'll write down the kinetic term for each of the gauge bosons here. And, okay, so let's say this gauge boson, I'll call it G mu nu for gluon. And this one, I'll call it W mu nu for weak. Oh, let's say, sorry. Really, the gauge boson only has one index. I don't know why I'm telling you this. It's completely random what stuff I'm telling and what stuff I'm not telling. It's like I said, it's just impossible. So I'm just winging it. So anyway, but for each of these gauge bosons, just like in electromagnetism, you have the electromagnetic potential. But the actual electric field, the thing that actually acts on the charge to as a force is the derivative of that guy with respect to. You have to differentiate that guy with respect to a space-time coordinate to get the field. Well, that's what's going on here. That phi is really like one component of the electromagnetic gauge boson. And each of these guys you can think of as some fancier version of the electric potential that you learn about when you first learn about electricity and magnetism. And when you differentiate these guys, they pick up another index and they become a field strength. And it's those field strengths that appear directly in the Lagrangian. And so it turns out that the only way you can you can combine up all of these guys in a way that is fully symmetric is for each one, there's this term you can write down, which is basically the square of that field strength. Okay, so there's a kinetic energy for each of the three types of gauge boson here. The strong force, the weak force, and the hypercharge.
Sorry.
What's the difference between G high and mu and G low?
Yeah, that's as good a thing to explain as anything, I guess. It's you know, that is a notation invented by Einstein. So in Einstein's theory of general relativity, the basic dynamical objects are tensors, and they have a bunch of indices hanging around. They can have a bunch of indices. They could, for example, this one has two so-called contravariant indices and two covariant indices. And what those indices mean is, so just like if you have a vector, let's say your velocity is this vector, and we express it in these coordinates, these x, y, and coordinates. Well, in those coordinates, this velocity vector has components 1, 1. But, you know, why did I choose these coordinates? They're just some random axes I drew on the board. I could have just as well chosen these coordinates, x prime and y prime, as my Cartesian coordinates. And in that system, we would say that V has coordinates, root 2, 0. In other words, it has no component along the y direction. So these tensors are generalizations of these vectors. A vector would be an object with one index, with just a single index here. So if I had something like that, what I would ordinarily call a vector. But tensors can have more indices. And the indices label the different components. So for example, if I just had one component and mu took on possible values 1 and 2, that would mu equals 1 would label this component, would be T1 would be this component of this vector, T2 would be this component. And the fundamental idea in general relativity, the fundamental symmetry behind it, is that as you change from one coordinate, you should be able to choose whatever coordinates you want. So you could choose these coordinates, but alternatively, you could change to these coordinates. And when you change coordinates like that, you have to have some rule. You have to know how to, if you knew the coordinates, if you knew the components of this tensor in the first coordinate system, how do you figure out what the components are of T prime? The same tensor, but just expressed in the new coordinate system. And there's a rule for how to transform this guy from this coordinate system to this coordinate system, and the indices. Yeah, and basically that when you have an up index, those components transform one way. When you have a down index, those components transform a different way. And if you want to have an object that doesn't transform at all, see, we're trying to build an object that does not transform at all, that is symmetric. You have to. What you really want is an object with no indices left over, no free indices. And so, for example, if you have an object like this. If you have an object like, let's say you just had an object with two indices like this, okay? Under a coordinate transformation, this guy changes. Its components are different in one coordinate system than another coordinate system. So it can't be the Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is supposed to be something that's invariant under such a transformation. So instead, It's a difficult call whether this is getting more comprehensible as I go along or less comprehensible. I'm so disappointed with my explanation of this. There is an additional rule. If you take an index that transforms like a lower index does, and then you, I really want to give up. I really want to give up. I'm just going to confuse you guys. An object that transforms like a tensor with lower indices can be turned into an object that transforms like a tensor with upper indices by using the so-called metric of space-time. There's this special tensor which tells you about the distances in space-time. And so if I apply, for example, this tensor, this metric tensor twice, so here, because this beta matches this beta, I've used the metric tensor to convert this lower index beta into an upper index gamma. And I've used this metric tensor, the fact that this alpha is the same as this alpha, means I've converted this lower alpha into an upper delta. So by just using the metric, I can convert a tensor with lower indices into a tensor with upper indices. And then there's one other thing, which is that if I have any upper indices, let's say on one object, and lower indices on another object, if I connect those with one another, so instead of taking these guys to be two indices and these to be entirely independent indices, if I make these two indices the same as these two indices, so I match the first one up and I match the second one up, then it's like this index then eats this one, and this index eats this one, and I'm left over with no indices. I have a completely scalar object with no indices. Voila, that thing does not change under a coordinate transformation. This is the sort of thing that my Lagrangian, that I want my Lagrangian to be, a thing that is invariant, is symmetric under coordinate transformations, doesn't transform. So that's what we've done over here. We've taken this lower index guy, g mu nu, used the metric twice to raise its to make another version of it with its indices raised up, and then we've connected up those indices so that there's no free indices left over, and now the thing is invariant under coordinate transformations. I cannot even say how disappointed I am with that explanation. I apologize for that. That was a mess. Anyway, I'm going to press on because as much as it was a mess, any further attempt to explain it will just make more of a mess. So then we want to write down the kinetic term for the fermions here. Well, Dirac was the one who figured out how to do that. Dirac realized that the only term you could write down built from fermions, only kinetic term you could write down that is invariant under space-time invariant under space-time transformations, like I just said these were. He was the one who figured out that there's only one possibility, and it's that you have to take one fermion, take its antiparticle, take another fermion, and sandwich a thing called the Dirac operator between them. Okay? And then, so that makes us invariant under space-time transformations, but then the requirement that we be invariant under all of these other gauge symmetries means that we can't just pair up any fermion with any other fermion in these kinetic terms. We're only allowed to pair up this guy with itself, et cetera. So we get six kinetic terms here, Q left with Q left. We get another one that's U right bar with U right. Another one that's D right bar. D right, and left-handed lepton with a left-handed lepton, and the right-handed neutrino with the right-handed neutrino, and the right-handed electron with the right-handed electron. Okay, so we get six kinetic terms like that. Then we have to write down the kinetic term for the scalar fields, and it turns out that that's basically, well, it's just like normal kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. So this is sort of like v squared. I take one derivative of the field and square it, okay, roughly speaking. Except I'm going to replace this by a capital D for reasons that I'm not going to explain. And then, okay, so but now it's time to go on to the potential terms. And so we're almost there. We're getting there. The formula is getting long and disgusting, just like I promised. So let's see. The easiest potential terms to write down are the ones we have to write down all the possible terms that are symmetric in all these ways, built out of these fields. So let's first ask, can we write any built just from the scalar fields by themselves? Can we build any just from the gauge bosons by themselves? No. Can we build any just from the scalar fields by themselves? Yes. There's two that we can write down. Okay. There's h squared. Okay. Where secretly this is h dagger h. And again, I will simply not explain that notation. And then we can take that same thing h squared, and we can square it again. Okay. Can we build anything just from the fermions themselves? Well, it turns out that there's only one thing we can build just from the fermions themselves. There's only one term. There's this special fermion, the right-handed neutrino, which is uncharged under SU3, uncharged under SU2, and uncharged under U1. It's uncharged under anything, and that turns out to allow me to write down a term that is invariant. That is invariant. Whereas if I had written that term down for any of the other fermions, it would not be invariant because they all transform in some way, whereas this guy does not. And in a long tradition of not explaining my notation, I will not explain this notation. Let's see, and now I'm, in addition to being incomprehensible, it's soon going to be invisible if I go lower. Is that right? Okay, so I'm just moving over here. There's just one other thing. There's only one other type of thing which I can write down, which are the so-called Yukawa terms, which are terms built from two fermions, a fermion and an antifermion, and a scalar. Okay, and it turns out the only possible ones that I can write down that are consistent with the symmetries are Q left, left-handed quark coupled with a Higgs boson, coupled with a right-handed up quark, Q left with a Higgs boson, with a right-handed down quark, L left with a Higgs boson, with a right-handed neutrino, and L left with a Higgs boson, with a right-handed electron, and voila. Oh, and we also want to add the Hermitian conjugate. There's the Lagrangian for the standard model. The rest of physics is left as a homework assignment. So but it really is true. The one thing I want to emphasize is that just like, you know, once you have this formula, it's a long, complicated formula, but it also fits on one chalkboard. And there's a well-understood algorithm for just taking this formula and manipulating it in various ways to calculate the predictions for basically every experiment that we've subsequently done on Earth, and you know, it continues to work great. So anyway, it's really a very important thing. I would make it your goal in college if you're going to be a theoretical physicist to, you know, let's say as an exercise by the end of college, if someone presents you this information in this table, be able to work out this formula, then you're doing very good. I think that's a very worthy goal. Anyway, so con. To make a long story short, remember we had to give three inputs here, 1, 2, 3. three, just unexplained, to just specify, before you could even start writing down the Lagrangian, before you could do that exercise, I just had to give you a bunch of input information up front with no explanation that we know of from this standpoint. So Kahn has a different algorithm for getting the same formula, but it's notable in that you give much less information up front. And so, in short, just to say some words, just to get them in your head, hopefully, so that you'll be alert to them next time you hear them or something. So in his approach, step one is you give something called an algebra. You have to pick an algebra and give that as input. That secretly is the same, is really the same as this. It's giving, you choose an algebra which is amounts to giving this information, the symmetries of the theory. And then you have to choose the so-called representation of that algebra on a Hilbert space. Anyway, representation of A on H. Algebra A on the Hilbert space H. Nonsense, I know. But then you're done, okay? So then in his language, so you see, the thing I want to emphasize to you about this is that although I have not had a chance to explain it, I've explained it, of course, even much less than I explained this, which I also didn't explain. the thing I want to emphasize is that here there were three independent steps. This guy, and this guy. So once I had specified the symmetries and the fermions in the theory, it was still a completely independent choice. I could have told you I could have added as many scalar fields to the theory as I wanted, and given them any charges that I wanted. It's a completely unexplained fact about the standard model. According to the usual approach, it is completely unexplained why there is just one scalar field and why it has these particular charges. Okay, in this approach, you do better. You do these first two steps, which, as I say, give the information equivalent to these first two steps. But then, because of the fact that in this, because that this is phrased in terms of his language of non-commutative geometry, it turns out that then the third step is not an input, it's an output. The fact that there is then one scalar field which has exactly the charges required to be what we call the Higgs boson is an output. And furthermore, a more sort of technical point is that at stage two, turns out that when I'm specifying sort of what the fermions are and their charges, in this language, it turns out I have much less freedom than I have over here. So a lot of unexplained facts about this table, not all of the properties of this table, but a number of unexplained facts of this table over here are explained on this side. So, to make a long story short, I just think you should be, this is not yet a widely known idea. It's not very popular. I mean, it's not widely understood. There's very few physicists who understand, or mathematicians who understand what it is that Kahn has done. His papers tend to be very hard to read, especially for physicists. But he's done something very important, I think. I think there's very good evidence based on arguments like this that the fact that this gives such a more tightly constrained and explanatory route to the standard model than that does suggests that it's a bit of progress, suggests that thinking about space-time as being a non-commutative geometry as opposed to a Riemannian geometry, which we did over there, is probably more correct. And so there's a lot to be worked out about what the implications of that are, basically. What does that mean for what comes next? I should stop there. Sorry for running over. I knew it was going to be incomprehensible at the start, but anyway, sorry for that also. And anyway, if you have any questions, please let me know. I ran through question time. I am staying for lunch. Yeah.
Okay. So if we have questions, we can sit with Blaise at lunch, and it's obviously very approachable. And let's give him a pause.